We will call the meeting of February 27th to order. The first item is House File 896 to come before us. Members, yesterday in our committee hearing, we amended the bill with an amendment, House File 896. We heard testimony for and against the bill as amended. And then Representative Purcell laid the bill over so that we could have a few more minutes today to take testimony from those that would be for or against the bill. Representative Purcell, you want to come up for the bill? And anyone interested in testifying for or against the bill, please come forward to do so. This is House File 896 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone interested in testifying for or against? There being none, Representative Purcell renews his motion that the bill be recommended to pass and go directly to the General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right, next bill on the list is House File 737. Representative Hansen.
Oops, maybe I want to reconsider my vote.
Wait for you, no.
I wish you good luck.
We get plenty of no votes anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. House File 37 is the Pollution Control Agency bill, and it is, I think you have in your packet the summary from House Research. So it is making some technical corrections to the Clean Water Fund appropriations. Mr. Kudelka has arrived just to help walk us through the bill.
Okay, so members, Representative Hansen moves that House File 737 be recommended passed and referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill will have many stops, and I know there are a number of questions and concerns and testimony, and I'm going to hand it over to Mr. Kudelka to walk through the bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. We do have a couple of amendments. I don't know if those have been put on or the oral ones.
Oh, they have not got to.
Go ahead with your amendments, Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Chair, on page 6, we have an oral amendment on line 6.20.
This is House File 737.
737. So on line 6.20, after the word, the second time the word corrective actions is used, period, and then the. So on the last word on 6.20, strike the, and then all the way down through 6.23, ending after the period after clause.
Delete
I'd
it
like
all.
To move that in order to get the bill into the shape I would like it in.
So, Representative Hansen, you are intending to delete that language, is that correct?
Delete that language.
Okay. Ms. Taylor, can you repeat that to make sure we have it correct?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would read on line 6.20, delete everything after the period, delete line 6.21 and 6.22, then on line 6.23, delete everything before a donation.
Is that correct, Representative
yes.
Hansen? All right. Discussion on the Hansen motion. Being none, in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next amendment.
Next, A2 or A1. So I'd move the A13.0081 amendment.
The amendment is before us. Go ahead to the amendment.
This is inserting the wastewater laboratory certification language, and I would move that, and Mr. Kudelka could describe that.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the language here, the wastewater laboratory certification language, is the policy language that goes together with the governor's budget request that was heard in the Finance Committee to create a certification program with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, taking that duty from the Department of Health in order to streamline and reduce costs for those laboratories that are currently doing the quality assurance and quality control issues. There is one other small change on the backs on line 2.10 through 2.12. This is a small change, to the environmental covenant language that Department of Admin requested, just that when we have an interest in property, it modifies how we get rid of or dispose of that interest if we no longer need it.
Questions on the 081 amendment? No questions? All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Another amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The 0082 amendment, and this is inserting an Article 2, and I will have, and I would move that amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like. Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Kudelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this amendment is another piece of the governor's budget that was heard in the environment finance piece. What we have proposed doing is moving the creation, changes within a sanitary district or dissolution of a sanitary district from the administrative work being done by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and in turn giving that to the Office of the Administrative Hearings, which does a lot of this work already with their municipal boundary adjustment unit. This is the policy language that would carry that out by removing a number of pieces of statute in MPCA chapters 115.18 through 115.37 and putting in a new chapter in the Office of Administrative Hearings, 442A.
So, Mr. Kudelka, my understanding, this is in a finance bill, but because of the deadlines, or the reason that the bills were given to us after the date the governor was supposed to get them to us, we have to bring this out, put it in the policy bill so that it can go through deadlines. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. We want government ops to see this because of rulemaking and other pieces.
All right. Questions on the 082 amendment? There being none, in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Is that the bill now in the shape that the author and the others would like to have it in?
That is correct.
You guys. Okay, so go ahead, Representative Hansen, with the bill. Mr. Kudelka, if you'd like to explain it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll go through the bill quite quickly here. This is the MPCA policy bill. It really is a collection of small, policy change, repeal of obsolete rules, and then also getting rid of some legislative reports or streamlining them. I'm going to work off the handout, the MPCA policy fact sheet. It's just easier to go through and kind of adds an order to it instead of going line by line through the bill. The first item happens to be Section 1, is the policy change for the Clean Water Fund. Currently, the Clean Water Fund has a number of requirements like any legacy amendment dollars attached to them, including reporting of FTEs and other requirements that we have to provide to the Legislative Commission. We are fine with those things. We put them into our contracts when working with local units of government and others to get that information. However, when we start working with the federal government, they like to use their form. Any changes that have to be made to that form to start getting the FTE numbers and other things, that new contract or partnership agreement has to go to DC and takes months to do. What we'd like to do is use the federal standard form. And what we will do is have a side agreements with the federal government to get the information on FTEs so we can still report that to the required entities. The same information is being provided to the public. It's just the administrative stuff behind the scenes is done to save time and less money spent on doing the paperwork and more on the projects and getting them done. The second item is the Petroleum Environmental Covenants. This is Section 5 through 8 and 10 in the bill. Currently under Superfund law, the state has the ability to create environmental covenants for us to be able to ensure that protective measures are adhered to on remediation sites, cleanup sites, so that when we do go in, do work, and make sure that the exposure risk for public health or the environment are eliminated, they stay eliminated, that they're not changed in some regard. The amendment, the oral amendment that Representative Hansen did, removed all the language that dealt with easements by condemnation, so eminent domain. I know there was some talk about that. That has now been removed from the bill. So that's no longer there. What we did is Actually took it straight from 115B.17, subdivision 15, from the Superfund law and just dropped it into the petroleum mediation program. But we have now taken out the eminent domain. What this will allow for us to do is currently, if we have a site, for instance, a site where there was a leak, we may ask them to, we may not get all the soil from underneath that's contaminated. And the case here is the Greenway Co-op and Chatfield, for example. There was over 2,000 gallons of free product remaining at the site. As best we could only get about 300 gallons of it. So it left a number of it sitting there. It was very thick and immobile. And so what we ended up doing is we did a survey. There were no drinking wells in the surrounding area. And what we worked with the landowner is to put an agreement on the title that there were restrictions on what structures could be done there to protect against other cases where someone may drop a well right into the plume or next to a plume and start moving it inadvertently. What this does is it allows for the agency to, as this moves along, where the protective measures are put on a title, saying, for instance, contact the agency or you can't dig underneath the protective cover. For them to do any work there, they have to check with us. Currently, what can happen is it may be on a deed voluntarily. The holder will be the landowner. So when they go to the local unit of government for a building permit, and it says there, you can't disturb the soil because there's remediation effort underneath it, and the holder is the landowner, the local unit of government will talk to the holder and see if it's okay. Well, if they're the one proposing it, they're going to say what they're wanting to do is okay. What we're asking to do is to be able to have us as the PCA be the holder, and so that when it goes to that local unit of government and they say, I want to drop a well down there, they do check in with us first. And to do that, under the current law, we do have to become a holder, which means we have to acquire an interest in the property. And that's what these sections lay out. We have seen right now about 1% of our sites for the petroleum remediation program where we would use this. There have been a number of cases, including the one I talked about in Chatfield. Yeah. Also, recently, we had cases where we'd like to use this in Proctor, and others were residential properties. Again, one of those protective measures to avoid future health risk was to state that any future construction would to the property would be slab-on-grade construction and would require a vapor barrier. Those are the type of things that we want to do, because if they would have dug down in, they would again opened up, undone the work we did, and what state dollars have done to clean up the site. There have been some concerns expressed to us. We are committed to keep working with the various parties, League of Minnesota Cities, petroleum marketers, and others on this. I think we can address those concerns, and we will continue to do that before it goes to civil law and the other committee stops. The next couple items are changes in legislative reports. One's a correction from last year on the e-waste and toxics report and packaging. We just, right now, we didn't connect some statutes together, so we actually have to do the report twice. We'd only like to do it once. The other is the Superfund report. It's currently a report that's due every year. We'd like to do it every 2 years that matches the budget. And finally, the Metropolitan Landfill Contingency Action Trust account, we'd like to repeal that report. Currently, this is a fund in the metropolitan area used to for the long-term care of landfills. Right now, the fund is collecting revenue. However, there are no actions being taken that's withdrawing dollars from there. In essence, the report is a fund statement which we produce in other areas. Activity will not be done from this account for another 30 years until the existing landfills in the metropolitan area have closed and the commitment by those folks owning a landfill are over after 20 years. At that time, it would be more appropriate to have reports on what's being done with that money. But until money is being spent, at this point, we don't believe the report's needed. The final item is the repealers. Every year, every state agency needs to do an obsolete rules report. In addition, last year, the legislature requested the conservation agencies to go through all their rules and look through and see where there were various ones that needed changes. Our report identified a number of them. Three specifically we identified as the way to take care of them would be to go to the legislature and ask for repeal, because they're very easy just to take the language out. There are still some remaining ones that we mentioned in the report. We will do an obsolete rulemaking to take care of, because while the legislature can do something very quick, when you have to start piecing together sentences that may need the repeals, we do need to go through the rulemaking process on that. And again, these are areas where we have something already in place. The first example is Chapter 721. We currently have other state requirements in place for the federal emissions control on sulfur dioxide. There are federal regs and also other parts of state rules that govern this area, that same technology. For instance, Chapter 7011 has the same type of equipment as addressed in some of the stuff we're repealing here. The changes on Rule 9210 are from the old solid waste processing facility demonstration program. That pre-existed our current solid waste processing facility program, also known as CAP. We don't need two programs. We'd like to get rid of the old program. And finally, it's reporting requirements on waste tire transporters. We've gone through a number of changes, and the rule no longer reflects what is currently being done. That, Mr. Chair and committee members, is our bill. Is the bill as you see here. The other pieces I mentioned are the two amendments where the budget policy pieces for the waste lab certification program and the sanitary district changeover from us to the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Questions for members? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if we're going to hear from the petroleum folks in regards to the section about that.
We absolutely are, as soon as we get done with the questions. And then we may have more questions. So, further questions? There being none, those who would like to testify for or against the bill, actually, we have a list. We'll go through the list first. Mr. Quillis from the chamber.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I will be brief. Mr. Kadelka highlighted some of the concerns that we had dealing with the petroleum tank sections, specifically Section 6 and Section 7 of the bill, and I want to thank him and Representative Hansen for the amendment on 6.20 and 6.22. Understand that there's a couple of more stops along the way, and have pledged to work with Representative Hansen as this bill moves through the process to address some of those concerns, Mr. Chair.
Okay, questions of Mr. Quillis? Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McNamara. We may have a question for Mr.
Quillis. Are you supportive of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, the consolidation of the reports, no problem with the addition of the sanitary districts, and there was one other amendment, Mr. Chairman, we don't have any concerns with, but we do have some concerns with the petroleum. Some of our members have some concerns about the petroleum, specifically the petroleum tank sections in the bill.
Okay. I think, Mr. Chairman, it's okay. I think I'll prefer my questions. They're concerning the petroleum, but I think I'm assuming the petroleum folks themselves will come down, and I'm thinking our questions would be better for them. Thank you.
And that's Mr. Kelleher is here today, representing the Minnesota Petroleum Association. Welcome, Mr. Kelleher. State your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. We have about 700 members, and we deliver fuel oil, propane, and market gasoline through our convenience stores throughout the state. The short version is it's sort of as it's written. Yes, we oppose the bill. I have had some discussions with Kirk Kadelka and with Representative Hansen in regards to our concerns. I believe some of them may have been addressed in some of those amendments. But, you know, just for the record, I think we're still questioning what brought this language forward and why it is a needed tool for the agency to have. We're also questioning whether what is the appeals process for these restrictions if the language on page 5, lines 516 through 525, which are the institutional controls, which I think are a wide variety of definitions that obviously weren't in Chapter 114E previously, which is the Uniform Environment Covenants Act. And none the least of which on 5.19 is the term or reasonably required to ensure the corrective action protects the public, so on and so forth. As most of you know, and certainly I do because it's been put into my head over the years, that the term reasonable is difficult to determine. What's reasonable for one is not reasonable always for another person. And so, like I said, we sort of are, you know, looking for why is the need that this new language needs to be put into statute. It does, we believe, leave the agency a lot of power that they may or may not have today, given on these institutional control definitions and the remainder of the language on page 6, 616, this is clause 11, taking into consideration the amendment itself. I think the two examples that at least I did not personally speak with agency staff, but Bob Krogman from the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers did, and the two stories that he relayed in an email to me and was described as is that these were not not solutions that were unrepaired between the landowner, the convenience store in this case, and the department, that the two examples were mutually agreed on to what's the solution. And what would be an appropriate solution between the landowner and the agency. And the petroleum remediation program has been established since 1987. It gives the department determination and the ability to vary what's an appropriate remediation for 5 gallons of gas, 500 gallons of gas, 5 million. And it's up to the agency, is my understanding, to determine what's an appropriate remediation for that land based on the type of soil that it is and so on and so forth. And we're just sort of wondering why this extra language is needed, and we just haven't heard a good example so far as to why we think this is a necessary new tool.
Hey, thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kelleher, and maybe my question is actually for Commissioner Kadelka, but I don't understand why they need this, and I think that's what you're saying, that. And so I guess, Mr. Chair, my question is just for Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Kadelka, could you come up, please?
Commissioner Kadelka, I'm trying to figure out, don't the properties already have a note on the title now that this is a, whatever you call it, petroleum remediation site, and that's on the title, is it not? And the title, the owner knows that.
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, committee members, and Representative McNamara, it can be put on the title by the current landowner. They would be the holder. However, whether, and it's likely not going to be the case where it's the first landowner, it's subsequent landowners that may not have voluntarily put it on there. They then have the ability to decide if they want to follow through with it. Because they are the holder of that covenant, and that's who the local units of government will check with or others when they are looking to get approval that would be opposite of what's the environmental covenant. They have the sign-off. The agency needs the ability to acquire interest in the property to be able to be a holder. 114E.05 subdivision 7 talks about the definition of holder, and the first sentence of 114E.10 says that a holder has to have an interest in real property. And right now, we don't have that ability. We do under Superfund. This law was changed quite a bit when the Chapter 114 was created in 2007 during the larger debates on property issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Kadelka, but this is a site that's had a leak, and they've gone in and done a repair, and your concern is where they haven't been able to mitigate all the, in the case you used, the petroleum that was still there. Isn't it on the title of the land now that this is a remediation site and the landowner knows that? I mean, they have to. It's right on their title. And do you give them guidelines for, or is there any guidelines involved in that? Or are you saying they don't have that?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair, committee members, and Representative McNamara, it is correct that it's on the title, but because they are the holder, the individual landowner, my understanding is they are the ones that, in effect, are the ones who get to enforce it and abide by it. It's when the agency is there to have the check and the ability to say that, yes, you're doing what can be allowed or not. That's the difference. So in the case here where we may not want someone to disturb the soil, as you mentioned, the landowner, and it's likely not going to be the first one because they voluntarily put it on, they know about it. It's the folks down the line that will not. And again, if there is other pieces here where it goes beyond what our needs are and other folks see that, We're more than willing to meet with them in between now and civil law to work out those issues. For instance, when the eminent domain issue was brought up, well, we had talked about it. We talked about it internally and found a solution to remove that provision because it was more than what we needed. We were trying to create a uniform program between Superfund and the Petroleum Mediation Program, but we are scaling it back in this case because the programs are a little different.
Follow-up, Representative McNamara?
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but I'm trying to understand. So this is remediation that you haven't been able to, for whatever reason, you gave an example of where you couldn't get rid of the rest of the fuel. And so it's not on the title what the conditions of what they can do. It doesn't say land can't be disturbed. It, I would. So we haven't dealt with that on the front end to say here what the conditions are of this land and this title. This, because this is a really thorough program that you have. I can't. And do you have examples of where it didn't work and we have serious problems?
Mr. Kadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Representative McNamara, they are not required right now, I'm being informed, to put it on their title. We do work with them. Oftentimes, they will voluntarily do that, but they are not required.
Representative Bugle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelka, under this current scenario, all right, the PCA is going to be taking an interest in the property, and an interest in real property normally is a bit of a taking here. Are you going to be paying for any of that interest?
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, usually that is part of the remediation cleanup plan. The part of their responsibility is that piece where they would have to abide by those institutional controls, those protective measures put in place to be able to prevent exposure. So they may not... In turn, that's what their requirement is to fulfill their needs to, as a responsible party, to clean up the land. That's part of their requirements, much like they would be required to cover a portion of the cleanup if it was an X dollar amount to do the excavation.
Mr. Chair, but what I'm asking is you're taking an interest in real property. You're at least requesting to take an interest in real property on that. So that's depriving the landowner somewhat, some way. Is the PCA going to be paying that landowner for your small interest in the property?
Mr. Chair and committee members, that is part of their expense for the cleanup program, is keeping those institutional controls. And what you're mentioning there, the protective measure may restrict their ability to build and that value there. That's their share of paying for cleaning up the site. So when we do these institutional controls, it is often the case where we can't get at the pollution itself, so we've done protective measures to prevent exposure to it. So in absence of them having to dig it up, their responsibility is that they do have to be in a situation where they do have a less ability to develop. That is, they're, instead of paying a dollar amount to do the cleanup, it's that lost ability in the development is what they're paying for to make sure the site is clean and safe.
Mr. Chair?
Have you gone?
Well, what I'm getting at is the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency paying this individual some small amount because you are taking a position on his real estate that he owns? And I understand that you're not doing that now.
Mr. Cadell.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the responsible party, because of the spill, is responsible for cleaning it up. They have that debt to the state and to the public health and the environment to pay off. In a result, we are not passing cash over to them for that interest. They are doing that to meet their obligations for the cleanup and the protection of public health and the environment.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one other question. Now, once this, correct me if I'm wrong, deed restriction is put on, and there's notice in the deed that there's been a spill and everything else, what is the procedure, and I hope it's not encumbering the landowner too much, to get that deed restriction removed once everything is cleaned up?
Commissioner Cadell.
Mr. Chair and committee members, oftentimes these are put in places where a cleanup is not possible. When the threat does go away, we have put in the bill on Section 8, page 7, a way there for the agency to get rid of that interest in real property. But it would have to, in the case, let's say a petroleum plume underneath a property of land, it would have to shrink enough so that it no longer poses that risk. And so that will take time. It isn't something that's going to be measured in years. It'll be more in decades. But we have put in here to make sure in those cases where that threat is gone, we can remove that interest, we can remove the restriction, and that's outlined in the statute to make sure that can be done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kadelka, on page 7, you just mentioned that it's a new question for me. It says that if the commissioner determines, what are the right of appeal that a property owner has in this case?
Kadelka?
Mr. Chair and committee members, sorry. On this piece here for the disposal of the property in particular, that's going to be something that will be to their favor. They're going to want to get rid of that restriction. So in that case, they likely won't appeal. On the rest of it, I will need to get back to you on the specifics of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was kind of one of my other broader questions, not just with this section, but with the entire portion of the bill. Dealing with this, as far as what are the appeal processes that we have in place? I'm curious to know, and this kind of goes along Representative Uglum's questions too. Where is this not working? Where is the system broken so that we have to do this? Give me an example,
Mr. Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague real quick.
Welcome. Introduce yourself, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Chris McLean with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Petroleum Remediation Program. Oh. And I guess in where situations where this is not working right now, our concern is that if we go ahead and request an affidavit of notice put on a piece of property or try to engage in an environmental covenant, that without this holder status, we will, if at a later date, property owner decides to remove those items from the deed, we would not be notified. So therefore, the agency would not be notified of any notification being removed from the deed, and therefore, the protective measures may not be passed on to the future buyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but can you give me an example of where that has happened at this point?
Where it has been removed and we did not know about it?
Exactly.
I'm not aware of one.
Well, we have Representative Brazil.
Nope. I'm sorry.
If I may, Mr. Chair, and I might be able to shed a little light on a couple of those questions as a fellow been working on a Superfund site for 30 years. I'm going to try and be brief here, but I think, Representative Uglum, we got to the core of what you were saying. This is a trade-off. Instead of spending $1 billion, and I'm just using numbers here, to clean that up, the responsible party says, okay, we'll put this deed restriction on. We'll do something different instead of MPCA making us clean this thing up to spend millions and millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. So they put these deed restrictions on. Where it didn't work is in the Superfund site that I'm have some responsibility for as a technical guy up on the Leech Lake Indian Reservation. They didn't put the deed restrictions on back in the 80s, and property got sold to people that had no idea that they couldn't use the groundwater underneath because it was contaminated. So they paid good hard money for a piece of property that they can't even use the groundwater on. So that's what, if I understand, that's what we're looking to prevent here, and without Pollution Control Agency having that additional capacity to hold feet to the fire on this thing and have record on it, things get lost. Go get a deed. You know how the deed title searches and stuff that are done. Things get lost in the process if they're even there. Thank you. I'll stop.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and committee members, just back to the question. The current process, no one would have to let us know if they pulled it off their title. They could be doing that today and we would never know. And that's what this law change would they would at least have to contact us first.
To that point, Representative McNamara?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, or Mr. McLean, my experience with this program is even after you clean it up, it goes on the title of the land forever that it was remediated. It's on the title. The new people that buy the land, it's on the title. Is that not your current way it's done today?
Mr. McLean.
Mr. Chair, committee members. No, currently that's not required.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. McLean, is it your policy? Do you request that? Do you lead the people that are part of the process to believe that it's required?
No, we do not.
Okay, we'll talk offline. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
I'd like to know, Mr. Chair, I'd like to know how many sites, how many deeds have these sorts of restrictions in the state?
Petroleum remediation sites?
Yeah.
Less than a dozen.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just from a different perspective, having sold real estate for 13 and a half years, from the buyer's perspective, having a cloud on the title is not fun to find, but it's better to know it and then be able to deal with it. If you're buying a lot of land, and as Representative Purcell in your example, that my first thought was lawsuits. That's what's going to happen. And then you get a lot of people in a lot of trouble, spending a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of frustration. It would be very simple to add it to the deed, to the title, so that it could be tracked. And if eventually the oil went away, somebody could petition and have that taken off.
Well, this all started with Mr. Kelleher, and so we're going to ask for him if we have any more if you have any more to say about this, and you'd like to anyone have any questions of Mr. Kelleher. If not, we're going to call up the next testifier. Okay, Mr. Coyle. Next. Yep. You're up.
Up and up. Good afternoon, Chairman Dell, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle from Larkin Hoffman. I represent Casey's General Stores. Casey's is a general convenience store operation based out of Iowa with about 120 stores located in the state of Minnesota, primarily in southern Minnesota. Mr. Chair, you already had lots of discussion, so I'll be quick. Our concern relates to Sections 5, 6, 7, and 8 of the bill. You've heard many of the same arguments that I would make. I'll make one that's a little different than what you've heard. And while we acknowledge and appreciate the amendment that was offered by the author, Representative Hansen, taking out the condemnation authority, because that's frankly the biggest hammer that was going to be built into this bill, but there still is a hammer. And I would just give you kind of the ground level view of that hammer. When you're the property owner who is trying to work out a corrective action and negotiation with the MPCA, and sometimes with the local community that you're working with the institutional controls authority that's being proposed, you've opened up what I'll call a Pandora's box of leverage that can be imposed on that property owner who's trying to do the right thing, but the price of getting the approval of the agency for their plan and then potentially a resale down the road is this new authority that will be created that will give the city, we don't know for sure if it's going to be the city doing this or the state, that will give the city or the state the ability to, I'm going to just say, extract land concessions in the way of covenants or otherwise that may not be necessary, may not be appropriate, may be overstated. But nonetheless, the property owner, as the price of getting through this difficult hoop, is going to have to be willing to make that concession in order to get their plan approved. Now, I'm going to presume good intentions on the part of the agency and the local units of government, but unfortunately, that's not 100% reliable. And the concern we have is that this is going to open up the property owner to concessions that are not strictly required nor warranted, and they're not going to be compensated for them. And there's other comments I could make, but I won't in the interest of time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Coyle, I know there's a tank cleanup program mm-hmm. that is paid into, and I thought that program was working very, very well. And so I don't know what this huge concern is all of a sudden in this bill, because that tank program has been doing a tremendous, terrific job of cleaning up these sites. And so maybe you can comment on that, how that tank program's been working, or maybe Mr. Kelleher would have to come and speak to that issue.
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to Tom, of course, but from my own client's experience, we think the program works very well, and we're appreciative that it exists.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chairman, again, my name is Tom Kelleher, representing the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. I've been lobbying for the petroleum marketers since about 1994. I think the Petroleum Tanker Lease Cleanup Fund outdates me by 8-10 years. Over the years, it's been the parameters of who can have access to that fund has grown to include local governments and schools and other sorts of things. A lot of it is run by the Department of Commerce, but I think it's certainly in conjunction with project directors who are in charge of cleanups that are approved by the department. And we like the program. I think it runs very well. And it provides a benefit to the owners of convenience stores in the fashion that it helps with the liability for potential spills and the cleanups thereof. So we are very happy with the program.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Coyle, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Coyle, just to your point about the title of the deed restrictions on the property and
right. That
may be problematic, I would just offer to you that the folks who represent these property owners with contaminated property, they have the option, do they not, to clean it up to an unrestricted use. They have that option.
Mr. Coyle.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you're correct.
Thank you.
But the concern, of course, is that the authority that's being created here under the institutional control section of the bill would open up the property owner to an agency demand that goes beyond that literal compliance requirement.
What the agency is proposing, thank you, Mr. Chair, what the agency is proposing is no more than what the law requires for a cleanup. If it's not cleaned up in totality to unrestricted use, how are you going to avoid what happened up in my neck of the woods where property got sold because there was no deed restriction on it and people thought they could use the groundwater? That's what we're protecting here. We're protecting the people that are going to buy that property. Your folks can clean it up. You can clean it up spick and span as you need off of it. They can do that. They can spend that money doing that.
I didn't hear a lot of questions in there, but do you have a comment on that?
Nothing further.
Representative Wagenius.
No. Representative Purcell said it very well. Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe my question is for Representative Hansen, the author of the bill. Representative Hansen, it seems to me that what's lacking here is the notification to stay on the deed. Why don't we just make that notification non-removable if they haven't fixed it? Wouldn't that take care of it? It seems like the commissioner is saying there's a problem with that notification. Not that that necessarily is the ideal situation, but if that's the issue, why are we not just doing that? That seems like a lot simpler fix.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara. I've committed to work with the folks who have testified raising their concerns on this bill. This is an agency bill. The next stop is civil law, and following civil law goes to government operations if it passes out of that. So I think the conversation will continue on what's the best way to protect the public and to make sure this is workable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who this question is for, but say that a convenience store owns a corner lot someplace in a new area of town or out in Wenaska, Minnesota, and the title property description is for an area that is substantially larger than where the spill is, okay, where the contamination is. It might be 3 or 4 acres that they bought up, but the contamination is restricted to an area that's the size of this room or smaller. What protection does the landowner have to be able to do something with the rest of their property under this situation?
Mr. Kadelka. Did you understand that question, Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Fabian, my understanding is what can be done so only if only portion of the land has the pollution or contamination We can draft in a way that it only is particular to that portion. We can state in the environmental covenant that it's only the portion of the land that has the pollution. If everything else is clean and free, we don't have to put an environmental covenant. We can make that distinction on the title. So you're correct, we can do it for part of the property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, Commissioner Kadelka, you and I have worked together a lot on a lot of different things. I heard you say we can do it. I've also heard you use the word if today. I've heard you use the word usually. I've heard you use the word think we can do it. I'm sorry. I've got some real concerns about how this bill is moving forward. Not that I'm opposed to getting things cleaned up. You know that very well. But I do have some serious concerns, and quite frankly, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if I'm smart enough to get them addressed.
Okay, Mr. John. General
Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Have a few different comments, one or two that are supportive, so I should get those out of the way quick so someone has done that. First thing I would say is both the League of Cities and the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities has support for the amendment that deals with water quality testing. That's a problem that's been going on for a long time, trying to get a broader range of facilities available for doing that to keep costs down for smaller facilities, and this does address that, so we appreciate that being part of the legislation. We also do appreciate the amendment that removed the eminent domain portion of this. While it doesn't necessarily directly affect cities, anytime one of those happens in your jurisdiction, you really don't have a lot of fun when that's going on. So to our remaining concerns with the bill, I want to thank the agency. They've spent a lot of time trying to help me understand what this does and what they're trying to do today. Our concerns from the local government level really do focus, it's on, you know, sections 5 and 6 in the remaining part of the bill, really. And we understand what the agency is trying to do here. They need a way to have this covenant and affidavit to travel with contaminated property so that you know in the future what restrictions are on it and they don't just disappear and be forgotten about. We get that. The language, though, that's added in section 6 is just cut out of Superfund legislation, and it's much, much broader than that. And I would point out, for instance, that in line 5.18, it includes located at or adjacent to. So this now affects adjacent properties also. And they could be brought in under institutional controls and corrective actions under this with ongoing requirements on them. I would also add that it is not just actions of the state included. If you look at lines 15.22 and 23, it includes the requirement for ordinance, official controls, zoning, building codes, and official maps. The state has no authority to do any of that. That would be a mandate on the local government to come up with those restrictions, put them in place, enforce them, and monitor them. And that would be ongoing, and of course the local government would then get the fun of dealing with any takings claims for change of use under that or for any ongoing problems dealing with non-conforming uses that are created because of those changes in use for the property. So we do want to work with the agency to get what they need addressed here, but we don't want to just throw in really expansive language that makes a program that we really haven't had a lot of trouble with suddenly something that people are very nervous about instituting or using in a community, because we think it has been a very effective program. So,
well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, just one quick question. So your concerns on 522 and 5223, do I interpret you to say that this is an unfunded mandate to the local government?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fabian, it could be. It depends on how it's used, where it's used, and why it's used. So it just depends on the circumstance.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, in response to Representative Fabian, that it could be, as he says, and I agree. It also could be that if the local unit of government does not understand that they're parked, they have property next to a contaminated property, they can have a huge liability that goes far beyond this unfunded mandate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Purcell. I appreciate that. But then, you know, let's clean up the rest of the language so that we can accomplish both things. I think most people, some people around here are smart enough to do that. I'm not sure I am. Thank you.
Any further questions, Mr. Johnson? That being none, I would like to testify for or against the bill. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Please come forward at this time. There being none, Representative Hansen, do you have further on your bill?
No, I would renew the motion to pass it as amended to civil law.
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like this bill needs some additional work, particularly in the area that we oversee in this committee. And I know the bill's going to be moving forward. There's going to be changes that are going to take place along the way. I don't know if those changes that Representative Hansen is going to be working on with the petroleum industry are going to be those changes that are going to concern us or not. It sounds like the local governments have some concerns. Could we see the bill back here again, Mr. Chairman, after it's gone through all the committees, if we could get a commitment from the author to make sure that the bill comes back here after it's gone through all the other committees? I'd appreciate that, just to see any changes that may have been made and that may address some of the concerns that were raised here today.
There is a deadline problem. I can tell you that Representative Hansen and I have had a serious discussion about this provisions in this bill, and frankly, I am very, very, I'm not even lukewarm on these provisions. So Representative Hansen and I have an agreement that we serve on GovOps, and if these can't be resolved, we will remove these provisions from the bill in GovOps.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and I've talked with some of our members, and if we couldn't see the bill back here again, I'm going to have to ask for a roll call on the bill as it stands now. We were going to withhold that and not do that if we could see the bill back here again, but under the circumstances, then I would have to ask for a roll call, Mr.
Chairman. Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Representative Hansen renews his motion that the bill, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Civil Law. Aye.
Aye.
Talking to Mike.
Benson?
Not here.
Cornish?
Cornish not here.
Fabian?
No.
Green?
No.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Isaacson?
Yes.
Johnson C?
Yes.
McNamara?
No.
Purcell?
Aye.
Uglum?
No.
Virginius?
Aye.
Ward?
The bill passes as amended on 8-5. Motion prevails. Next bill.
Thank you.
We are going to do Representative Wagenius.
Yes, as the next person is coming up, let me just ask a question about House File.
Could you hang on one moment, Representative Wagenius, so we can hear a little better? All right, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not here for the vote on House File 896, and I just want to assure myself that from our discussion yesterday, that it is your intention that this bill go to the floor, and be on the general register, that it not be called up. Am I getting that correctly?
My intention was, and the bill was sent to the general register, and you were not here to vote on the bill. There was one no on the bill, and my intention is to put it on the general register and wait and see what the DNR does, and if by the time that the DNR doesn't do anything, then I'm going to bring it up.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, you are this is a financial bill. It is obligating the state to spend money, and in that case, the question of where it went, it should not have gone to the floor. It should have come to the Finance Committee. Well, it was my understanding that it wasn't going to be brought up, and under those circumstances, we would not need to see it in the Finance Committee, but if it is to be brought up on the floor, it will need to be referred back to the Finance Committee first.
All right. We will have that discussion offline, and at the next meeting, we will bring it back up and decide how that's going to work.
Fine.
Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. So the next bill before us is the Purcell Bill on Road Easements, House File 778. Representative Purcell, do your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Like Representative Purcell, you move your bill, House File 778, recommend to pass, and referred to the Committee on Government Operations.
Go ahead
to the bill.
Thank you. And do have A13 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Purcell moves the A130110 amendment. Discussion on the amendment? Being none, in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. To your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not gonna say a whole lot of words about this. This is a DNR agency bill, and I'm gonna ask them to come down and help me out with this. But there's a number of things in here that have a good positive impact on forestry activities and timber harvest, and that's a significant issue in the state of Minnesota. So I'm happy that we're addressing these issues, and I'll ask Forrest Bowe to talk about the bill.
Mr. Bowe, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Forrest Bowe, Director of Forestry with Minnesota DNR. Members, today we have this House file in front of you. There are three main components to our bill. The first component is allows the DNR to complete more efficient and cost-effective exchange of access easements. The second component has to do with our forest management investment account, really just a bookkeeping item. Has no impact on the fund balance or things like that. And finally, probably the longest portion of the bill is with regard to Chapter 90 revisions, and this chapter governs our state timber sales program. And this chapter and the revisions in the aforementioned language will improve our business and financial practices. It provides more flexibility and marketing of our state timber. It increases our efficiencies in the administration of timber sales, and we've had a lengthy review of this chapter by DNR staff. We've also included our partners from the forest industry and others, and I can go through each section of the bill if that's what the chair and the committee would like.
All right, what we'll do, we'll have Mr. Brandt come up on the amendment. You stay there, Mr. Bowe. And we're going to have a short question and answer opportunity here on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Timber Producers Association and Minnesota Forest Industries. Minnesota Timber Producers Association's members are loggers, truckers, small sawmills, allied businesses from throughout the state. Minnesota Forest Industries are primary manufacturers of forest products and landowners, and also producers of utility poles and renewable electricity from wood. So thank you. We'd like to also thank the DNR for their work on this bill. We spent a lot of time on issues relating to the management of our state's lands and the funding and what the outcomes of that are. This bill is largely dealing with process issues, and we DNR has been very willing to listen to us on our views on this, and we appreciate it. We support the bill, particularly with Representative Purcell's amendment. I would also commend the division. We had spent quite a bit of time talking about things that were policy and not law related over the last couple of years to try and make our life simpler and their life simpler. I think many of you know that our industry has been under significant economic stress, and you know, some of those purely policy kinds of things from the department. One that I would cite was we had an issue with when timber sale permits expire. It's not an issue in law, but it's an issue of having, if you buy a three-year timber sale, having three full winter seasons to operate. And actually the department, and Doug Tilma, who's sitting over here, as we were talking about the problem, came up with the solution, which was let's just have all the timber sale permits expire in the spring instead of having them expire on an annual basis when they may have been sold in December, January, or February, and all of a sudden we don't have a full winter to operate them. So we commend the department and appreciate working with them on this. We support the bill. I would note on the amendment on the permit cancellations issue, just by way of explanation, that is something that we requested and worked with Representative Purcell and others on. I think many of you are familiar that the Verso paper mill in Sartell had an explosion last Memorial Day and the subsequent fire, and subsequently it was determined to not be feasible to rebuild that mill. Our loggers, in good faith, that provided wood, sold wood to that mill, had bought timber sales that they intended to harvest this winter, next winter, you know, next summer, the winter after that, anticipating that as a market. Well, through no fault of their own or anyone else's, that market is now gone. What this language does is provides a window until basically nearly the end of the next biennium, in which the loggers that own those sales hopefully will find a market, be able to harvest that wood and deliver it, and we would hope make a profit on that delivery and pay the state. If that doesn't happen, then they would have an out of a very limited nature for those sales. As you can see in the language, it would only apply to the balsam that's on those sales. They would still be obligated for the other species, aspen, maple, tamarack, whatever, spruce, whatever it may be. They would have to have a minimum amount of balsam, so not just anybody that's got one balsam tree on a sale can get out of it. And we think that the language also provides, and we're happy to do this, the opportunity to, if there's a silvicultural reason, to fell those trees for regeneration, to have that done. I mean, we'll eat that expense. So we appreciate working with the division on that. There may be, when we get to GovOps or finance or wherever else, there may need a little more tweaking on that, but that would be a great help. We don't think that there's going to be a lot of people come June 1 of 2015 that are going to need to use this provision, but for those that do, they're going to really need to use it. So I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. I have a question. So a logger on this particular pick-a sale could cut and skid the wood, but would not owe the wood until he sells it. Is that what this means?
No, Mr. Chairman, what it means is that the department could require him to cut the wood, but couldn't make them pay for it. So the department could say, all right, this balsam is mature, it's over mature, we need to have it felled, it could be left for, you know, to rot, you know, back down and provide the area for the new forest to grow. So we'd do that silvicultural work, we just wouldn't deliver it to a mill and hence have removed it and have to pay for it.
All right, I'm glad I got it, exactly. All right, thank you, Mr. Brandt. Questions for Mr. Brandt? Anyone? Anyone like to testify?
Oh. I have a question.
Representative Johnson.
Are you, Mr. Chairman, are you concerned at all by felling those that wood and not bringing it to the mill that there's a challenge to the forest at all? Okay. Health of the forest?
I defer to Director Bolt.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, it's actually the opposite. To leave those trees standing, they probably wouldn't survive anyway. They would dry up because they're balsam. They would probably be fire prone, and sometimes disease prone as well. And most importantly, they would shade out some of the other trees that we do want to grow on that site. So that's why it's important for us to get those on the ground.
Further questions? There being none, Representative Purcell renews House File 778 as amended to go to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor of the bill say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Johnson. Let's see, Representative Representative McNamara moved House File 228, the first engrossment, recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Representative Johnson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. The bill I brought forth today stiffens the penalties on wildfire arson in Minnesota. This issue came to light in 2009 on an arson fire in the Carlos Avery Wildlife Refuge. That spring was a dry year, and a member of the Forest Lake Fire Department intentionally set a number of fires in the Forest Lake area of northern Washington counties and Anoka County. This situation was brought to my attention by Santa County Assistant Attorney Robert Bienick, who was a firefighter working the fire, and over the past few years been working very hard on this issue, and should be needed, he is here to answer any questions if needed. While the Forest Lake Fire Department and a number of other fire departments in that area under the mutual aid agreement were putting out a number of intentionally set fires that were threatening buildings, another intentionally set fire in the Carlos Avery Wildlife Refuge grew out of control, ended up burning over 2,600 acres. That fire required over 120 fire units and over 200 firefighters and personnel to extinguish the fire, including a DNR helicopter and the supporting crew and a National Guard helicopter and crew and support staff. This fire not only affected that area, but it affected communities from over 30 miles away. I live in Cambridge, Minnesota. It's about 35 miles from Forest Lake, and the Cambridge Fire Department had to go to North Branch to cover the North Branch area because between this arson fire and a neglect fire at the northern part of Chisago County, every fire department in Chisago County, Washington County, and most of Anoka County, and a couple of fire departments from Isani County were at the Carlos Avery fire or the other large fire in northern Chisago County. So this doesn't just affect the community that this occurs in. It can affect a large area and a large number of communities all at the same time, drawing away not just the fire departments, but EMS, who had to be at the scene as long as law enforcement to close roads and keep the public safe and sometimes evacuate people from their homes. I've worked over 27 years in law enforcement and also taken courses on arson investigation. I've also spent 10 years as a firefighter and understand how hard arson is to investigate. the biggest, one big hurdle to come in arson investigation is the evidence collection. With fire, it generally burns up the evidence. Or unfortunately, with the extinguishing of the fire departments unintentionally destroy the evidence. This particular case was a rarity. They actually caught the person that was setting these fires. The situation that involves this bill of enhancing the penalties did not come to light till the penalty phase of the trial. The gentleman was convicted, but because of the way the law is written, he was only the judge was only able to give probation to this person, even though it holds up to currently up to a 5-year prison term. But because of no points and the way the law is written, it was just probation. Now, if a building had been damaged or destroyed, value of, I believe, $3,000 or more, he would have been sent to prison. But because no building was destroyed or damaged, he could only get probation. This change in the law, which would enhance the penalties a little, some if it's depending on the amount of acreage burned or if buildings were threatened, would give the judge an opportunity to actually put a person in prison for arson, for a large wildfire arson. It just gives some more teeth to the law. And I ask that you move this forward, and I'm open to any questions at this time.
Questions by the member. Representative Ackley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do have some reservations about this bill, and as you might know, Mr. Chairman, I've got a real problem, and so would of Representative Rukavina, when we turn people into criminals and make them guilty of felonies and turn them into felons. I'm also a 30-year firefighter with the City of Oak Grove. I've seen these kinds of situations. I was at the 2000 fire. I think it was 2000 when Carlos Avery caught fire, and that was a much bigger situation, and we had a lot more firefighters there then. And that was not intentionally sent, but it was an accident. I believe a homeowner within the boundaries of Carlos Avery was burning garbage or something, and not legally. He was illegally burning garbage, but it was an accident. He didn't intentionally set the fire that turned into a big mess. How do we address a situation like that make sure that that person is not charged in this way and turn that person into a felon? He never intended to start the fire, but he could be charged by this if somebody twists it in a way that says, you intentionally did it. You went out and you set your garbage on fire illegally, and now you burned down Carlos Avery. And now you're going to be charged with this. This was just a poor individual in the middle of barely making it, barely getting by that started that. And it was an accident. So how do we determine what is intentional and what is not? I know that what intentional is, but when we incidentally make it available so we can charge somebody that really didn't intend to. You follow what I'm saying? Trying to get at these people that accidentally started something and then they're charged with a felon and we turn them into a felon. How do we address that situation?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hackbarth, there is a definite difference between a neglect fire and a arson fire. In this particular case, this was intentionally set as a fire. The situation you described was not a arson fire. If there's other laws that apply to that, civilly he could have been responsible for the damages of the fire, which he should be for the neglect. And his insurance company should have taken care of that as much as his insurance provides. In an arson fire, the insurance companies don't pay for that. And this bill also specifies that the restitution, as well as restitution for any firefighters to get injured when the fire is intentionally set like this.
Mel, Mr. Johnson and Representative Hackbarth, I'm just reading online, the law says, a person who intentionally sets a fire, so a person who intentionally set a fire to burn garbage, even though it may be illegal, to burn garbage, it is illegal to burn garbage, mm-hmm. but the key words are, to burn out of control, is guilty under the proposal of a felony and may be sentenced as provided in subdivision A. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that the person that was set his garbage on fire set it to... First off, I have to say I'm agree. Hugh and Rukavina and I agree on this stuff. All right. So, but the person who set garbage on fire in your example, I don't think generally would do it or ever do it to burn out of control. And I think that that's the key element in here. But that can be up to debate. Representative Ugle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to also point that out. But Representative Johnson, could you give us some examples, for instance, like this individual or whatever, of intentional acts like this which would be covered under the bill?
In this particular case,
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Uglum, in this particular case, the gentleman was either using flaming arrows or large fireworks, intentionally shooting them at a low trajectory and multiple ones in an area to set the fire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all I need to know.
Mr. Chair, I've got another issue I'm dealing with. I was just walking out, but I heard the word fireworks. What was that all about? Could I add that?
The governor had just come in the room to tell us that he'd vetoed the fireworks bill that you and I passed last year in the legislature. So you really didn't miss anything, because that happened last year. But what was said is that the individual was, in the arson case, was using fireworks on the end of a bow and arrow to, you know, get a distance and not, you know, not be necessarily, maybe not even associated with the fact that it happened. So, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, you know, living in northwest Minnesota this past fall was probably as horrible as it could be for fires burning out of control. And you talked about departments showing up from 30 miles away. Well, those were probably the closest departments that showed up for some of the fires that we had. We had them from over 150 miles away. So I really appreciate the fact that we are trying to send a loud and clear message that we're not going to tolerate arson fires. And when I first started reading the bill, I had some questions about the intentionally part, the same as Representative Hackworth. But being the good fire teacher that I am, I read the rest of the sentence, as Representative Deal pointed out, and it's intentionally setting a fire to burn out of control. And, you know, I hope that any other questions that the group has or the committee has it can be answered. You know, I've got constituents in my district that are receiving letters from the DNR because they set a little brush fire on their property, and the next thing you know, you've accumulated a bill with that's worth $30,000+ and more. So I appreciate the fact that we're addressing this issue.
Well, while we're on, since we're on TV today, we'll bring up the fact that you have to have a permit to have a fire. You can't burn things illegally that aren't covered under a permit, and you are responsible for the fire and the damage that it causes if it causes damage, particularly off your own property.
Yep.
So these are really important things to know. And as was Representative Hackbar said, Representative Rukavina would probably be all over this. But in reading, as you said, this language, I'm ready to move forward on the bill. Well, we'll have to ask if anyone has like to testify for or against the bill. Now, there being none, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, I did text the fire chief in Carlstead and asked him about this bill and so forth. And he said, stiffer is better, but not if it's a permitted fire that got away. So thank you.
And I think that this would qualify under what? And you know, Representative Fabian, you are a real American. You're texting all the way up to the Canadian border, getting information right here in the House of Representatives. Wow!
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina would be proud of me, I'm sure.
He would be. So, unless there's further discussion, no one has indicated they want to testify for or against the bill. Representative McNamara renews his motion that the first engrossment of House File 228 be recommended to pass, referred to the Committee on Judiciary and Finance Policy. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.